The king took Strange's arm in a most affectionate manner, and seemed to have quite forgot that he disliked magicians. He began to talk about the things that preoccupied him in his madness. He was convinced that a great many disasters had befallen Great Britain since he had become mad. He seemed to imagine that the wreck of his own reason must be matched by a corresponding wreck of the kingdom. Chief among these delusions was the belief that London had been drowned in a great flood. "And then they came to me and said that the cold, grey waters had closed over the dome of St. Paul's Cathedral, and that London was become a domain of fishes and sea monsters. My feelings are not to be described. I believe I wept for 3 weeks together. Now the buildings are all covered in barnacles, and the markets sell nothing but oysters and sea urchins. Mr. Fox told me this 3 Sundays ago. He went to St. Verdast in Foster Lane, where he heard an excellent sermon preached by a turbot." Footnote 1. Charles James Fox, a radical politician who had died some 8 years before. This remark proves how far the king's wits were deranged. Mr. Fox was a celebrated atheist who would never, upon any inducement, have entered a church. "But I have a plan for my kingdom's restoration. I have dispatched ambassadors to the king of the fishes with proposals that I should marry a mermaid and so ends the strife between our 2 great nations. The other subject which preoccupied His Majesty was that of the silver-haired person whom only he could see. "He says he is a king," he whispered eagerly, "but I believe he is an angel. With all that silver hair, I think it very likely. And those 2 evil spirits, the ones you were talking to, he has been abusing them most horribly. It is my belief he has come to smite them and cast them into a fiery pit. Then, no doubt, he will carry you and me away to glory and Hanover."
"Heaven," said Strange. "Your Majesty means heaven." They walked on. Snow began to fall, a slow tumble of white over a pale grey world. It was very quiet. Suddenly, the sound of a flute was heard. The music was unutterably lonely and mournful, but at the same time, full of nobility. Thinking that it must be the king who was playing, Strange turned to watch. But the king was standing with his hands at his side, and his flute in his pocket. Strange looked around. The mist was not dense enough to hide anyone who might have been standing near them. There was no one. The park was empty.
"Ah, listen," cried the king. "He is describing the tragedy of the King of Great Britain. That run of notes there, that is for past powers all gone. That melancholy phrase, that is for his reason destroyed by deceitful politicians and the wicked behavior of his sons. That little tune, fit to break your heart, that is for the beautiful young creature whom he adored when he was a boy and was forced by his friends to give up. Ah, God, how he wept then."
Tears rolled down the king's face. He began to perform a slow, grave dance, waving his body and his arms from side to side and spinning slowly over the ground. The music moved away deeper into the park, and the king danced after it. Strange was mystified. The music seemed to be leading the king in the direction of a grove of trees. At least Strange had supposed it was a grove. He was almost certain that a moment ago he had seen 12 trees, probably fewer. But now the grove had become a thicket. No, a wood, a deep, dark wood, where the trees were ancient and wild. Their great branches resembled twisted limbs, and their roots tumbling nests of snakes. They were twined about thickly with ivy and mistletoe. There was a little path between the trees. It was pitted with deep ice-rimmed hollows and fringed with frost-stiffened weeds. Pale pinpricks of light deep within the wood suggested a house where no house ought to be.
"Your Majesty!" cried Strange.
He ran after the king and caught him by the hands.
"Your Majesty must forgive me, but I do not quite like the look of those trees. I think perhaps that we would be as well to return to the castle."
The king was quite enraptured by the music and did not wish to leave. He grumbled and pulled his arm away from Strange's grasp. Strange caught him again and half led, half dragged him back towards the gate. But the invisible flute player did not seem inclined to give them up so easily. The music suddenly grew louder and was all around them. Another tune crept in almost imperceptibly and blended sweetly with the first.
"Ah, listen, oh, listen," cried the king, spinning round. He is playing for you now. That harsh melody is for your wicked tutor, who will not teach you what you have every right to learn. Those discordant notes describe your anger at being prevented from making new discoveries. That slow, sad march is for the great library he is too selfish to show you.
How in the world, began Strange, and then stopped. He heard it too, the music that described his whole life. He realized for the first time how full of sadness his existence was. He was surrounded by mean-spirited men and women who hated him and were secretly jealous of his talent. He knew now that every angry thought he had ever had was justified, and that every generous thought was misplaced. His enemies were despicable, and his friends were treacherous. Gnarl, naturally, was worst of all, but even Arabella was weak and unworthy of his love.
Ah, sighed his majesty, so you have been betrayed too.
Yes, said Strange sadly. They were facing the wood again. The lights among the trees, tiny as they were, conveyed to Strange a strong idea of the house and its comforts. He could almost see the soft candlelight falling upon the comfortable chairs, the ancient hearths where cheerful fires blazed, the glasses of hot spiced wine, which would be provided to warm them after their walk through the dark wood. The lights suggested other ideas, too.
I think there is a library, he said.
Oh, certainly, declared the king, clapping his hands together in his enthusiasm. You shall read the books, and when your eyes grow tired, I shall read them to you. But we must hurry. Listen to the music. He grows impatient for us to follow him.
His Majesty reached out to take Strange's left arm. In order to accommodate him, Strange found that he must move something he was holding in his left hand. It was Ormskirk's Revelations of 36 Other Worlds.
Oh, that, he thought. Well, I don't need that any longer. There are sure to be better books at the house in the wood.
He opened his hand and let Revelations fall upon the snowy ground. The snow fell thicker. The flute player played. They hurried towards the wood. As they ran, the king's scarlet nightcap fell over his eyes. Strange reached up and straightened it. As he did so, he suddenly remembered what it was that he knew about the color red. It was powerful protection against enchantment.
Hurry, hurry, cried the king.
The flute player played a series of rapid notes which rose and fell to mimic the sound of the wind. A real wind appeared out of nowhere and half lifted, half pushed them over the ground towards the wood. When it set them down again, they were a great deal nearer to the wood.
Excellent, cried the king.
The nightcap caught Strange's eye again. Protection against enchantment. The flute player conjured up another wind. This one blew the king's nightcap off.
No matter, no matter, cried the king cheerfully. He has promised me nightcaps aplenty when we get to his house.
Strange let go of the king's arm and staggered back through the snow and the wind to fetch it. It lay in the snow, bright scarlet among all the misty shades of white and grey. Protection against enchantment. He remembered saying to one of the Willises that in order to practice magic successfully, a magician must employ the forcefulness of his own character. Why should he think of that now? Place the moon at my eyes, he thought, and her whiteness shall devour the false sights the deceiver has placed there. The moon's scarred white disk appeared suddenly, not in the sky, but somewhere else. If he had been obliged to say exactly where, he would have said that it was inside his own head. The sensation was not a pleasant one. All he could think of, all he could see, was the moon's face like a sliver of ancient bone. He forgot about the king. He forgot he was a magician. He forgot Mr. Gnarl. He forgot his own name. He forgot everything except the moon. The moon vanished. Strange looked up and found himself in a snowy place a little distance from a dark wood. Between him and the wood stood the blind king in his dressing gown. The king must have walked on when he stopped, but without his guide to lean on, the king felt lost and afraid. He was crying out,
Magician! Magician! Where are you?
The wood no longer struck Strange as a welcoming place. It appeared to him now as it had at first, sinister, unknowable, un-English. As for the lights, he could barely see them. They were the merest pricks of white in the darkness, and suggested nothing except that the inhabitants of the house could not afford many candles.
"Magician!" cried the king.
"I am here, your majesty." "Place a swarm of bees at my ears," he thought. "Bees love truth and will destroy the deceiver's lies." A low murmuring noise filled his ears, blocking out the music of the flute player. It was very like language, and Strange thought that in a little while he would understand it. It grew, filling his head and his chest to the very tips of his fingers and toes. Even his hair seemed electrified, and his skin buzzed and shook with the noise. For one horrible moment he thought that his mouth was full of bees, and that there were bees buzzing and flying under his skin, in his guts and his ears. The buzzing stopped. Strange heard the flute player's music again, but it did not sound as sweet as before, and it no longer seemed to be describing his life. "Place salt in my mouth," he thought, "lest the deceiver attempt to delight me with the taste of honey or disgust me with the taste of ashes." This part of the spell had no effect whatsoever. Footnote 2. When Strange reviewed the morning's events afterwards, he could only suppose that the flute player had made no attempt to deceive him by his sense of taste. "Nail my hand with an iron nail, so that I shall not raise it to do the deceiver's bidding."
"Ah, dear God!"
screamed Strange. There was an excruciating pain in the palm of his left hand. When it ceased, as suddenly as it had begun, he no longer felt compelled to hurry towards the wood. "Place my heart in a secret place, so that all my desires shall be my own, and the deceiver shall find no hold there." He pictured Arabella, as he had seen her 1,000 times, prettily dressed and seated in a drawing room among a crowd of people who were all laughing and talking. He gave her his heart. She took it and placed it quietly in the pocket of her gown. No one observed what she did. Strange next applied the spell to the king, and at the last step he gave the king's heart to Arabella to keep in her pocket. It was interesting to observe the magic from the outside. There had been so many unusual occurrences in the king's poor head that the moon's sudden appearance there seemed to occasion him no surprise. But he did not care for the bees. He was brushing them away for some time afterwards. When the spell was finished, the flute player abruptly ceased playing. "And now, your majesty," said Strange, "I think it is time we return to the castle. You and I, your majesty, are a British king and a British magician. Though Great Britain may desert us, we have no right to desert Great Britain. She may have need of us yet."
"True, true. I swore an oath at my coronation always to serve her. Oh, my poor country."
The king turned and waved in the direction he supposed the mysterious flute player to be.
"Goodbye. Goodbye, dear sir. God bless you for your kindness to George the Third."
Revelations of 36 other worlds lay half covered up by the snow. Strange picked it up and brushed off the snow. He looked back. The dark wood had gone. In its place was a most innocent clump of 5 leafless beech trees. On the ride back to London, Strange was deep in thought. He was aware that he ought to have been disturbed by his experience at Windsor, perhaps even frightened. But his curiosity and excitement far exceeded his uneasiness. Besides, whatever or whoever had done the magic, he had defeated them and imposed his will upon theirs. They had been strong, but he had been stronger. The whole adventure had confirmed something he had long suspected, that there was more magic in England than Mr. Norrell admitted. Consider the matter from whichever point of view he would, he continually came back to the silver-haired person whom only the king could see. He tried to recall what exactly the king had said about this person, but he could recall nothing beyond the simple fact of his silver hair. He reached London at about 4:30. The city was growing dark. Lights were glowing in all the shops, and the lamplighters were out in the streets. When he got to the corner of Oxford Street and New Bond Street, he turned aside and rode to Hanover Square. He found Mr. Norrell in his library, drinking tea. Mr. Norrell was, as ever, delighted to see the other magician, and he was eager to hear all about Strange's visit to the king. Strange told him how the king was kept a solitary prisoner in his own palace, and he listed the spells he had done. But of the drenching of the Willises, the enchanted wood, and the invisible flute player, he said not a word.
"I am not at all surprised that you could not help His Majesty," said Mr. Norrell. "I do not believe that even the Orient magicians could cure madness. In fact, I'm not sure that they tried. They seem to have considered madness in quite a different light. They held madmen in a sort of reverence, and thought they knew the things sane men did not, things which might be useful to a magician. There are stories of both Ralph Stokesy and Catherine of Winchester consulting with madmen."
"But it was not only magicians, surely," said Strange. "Fairies, too, had a strong interest in madmen. I'm sure I remember reading that somewhere."
"Yes, indeed. Some of our most important writers have remarked upon the strong resemblance between madmen and fairies. Both are well known for talking without sense or connection. I dare say you noticed something of the sort with the king. But there are other similarities. Chasten, as I remember, has several things to say upon the subject. He gives the example of a lunatic in Bristol who each morning told his family of his intention to take his walk in company with one of the dining chairs. The man was quite devoted to his article of furniture, considering it one of his closest friends, and held imaginary conversations with it in which they discussed the walk they would take and the likelihood of meeting other tables and chairs. Apparently, the man became quite distressed whenever anyone proposed sitting upon the chair. Clearly, the man was mad, but Chasten says that fairies would not consider his behaviour as ridiculous as we do. The fairies do not make a strong distinction between the animate and the inanimate. They believe that stones, doors, trees, fire, clouds, and so forth, all have souls and desires, and are either masculine or feminine. Perhaps this explains the extraordinary sympathy for madness which fairies exhibit. For example, it used to be well known that when fairies hid themselves from general sight, lunatics were often able to perceive them. The most celebrated instance which I can recall was of a mad boy called Duffy in Chesterfield in Derbyshire in the 14th century, who was the favourite of a mischievous fairy spirit which had tormented the town for years. The fairy took a great fancy to this boy and made him extravagant presents, most of which would have scarcely been of any use to him in his right mind, and were certainly no use to him in his madness. A sailing boat, encrusted with diamonds, a pair of silver boots, a singing pig.
But why did the fairy pay Duffy all these attentions?
Oh, he told Duffy they were brothers in adversity. I do not know why. Chasten wrote that a great many fairies harboured a vague sense of having been treated badly by the English, though it was a mystery to Chasten, as it is to me, why they should have thought so. In the houses of the great English magicians, fairies were the first among the servants, and sat in the best places after the magician and his lady. Chasten has a great many interesting things to say upon the subject. His best work is the Liber Novus. Mr. Norrell frowned at his pupil. I'm sure I've recommended it to you half a dozen times, he said. Have you not read it yet?
Unfortunately, Mr. Norrell did not always recall with absolute precision which books he wished Strange to read, and which books he had sent to Yorkshire for the express purpose of keeping them out of Strange's reach. The Liber Novus was safe on a shelf in the library at Hurtview Abbey. Strange sighed and remarked that the moment Mr. Norrell put the book into his hand, he would be very glad to read it. But in the meantime, sir, perhaps you would be so good as to finish the tale of the Fairy of Chesterfield.
Oh, yes. Now, where was I? Well, for a number of years, nothing went wrong for Duffy, and nothing went right for the town. A wood grew up in the market square, and the townspeople could not conduct their business. Their goats and swine grew wings and flew away. The fairy turned the stones of the half-built parish church into sugar loaves. The sugar grew hot and sticky under the sun, and part of the church melted. The town smelt like a giant pastry cook's. Worst still, dogs and cats came and licked at the church, and birds, rats, and mice came and nibbled at it. So the townspeople were left with a half-eaten, misshapen church, which was not at all the effect that they had in mind. They were obliged to apply to Duffy and beg him to plead with the fairy on their behalf. But he was sullen and would not help them, because he remembered how they had mocked him in the past. So they were obliged to pay the poor mad wretch all sorts of compliments on his cleverness and handsomeness. So then Duffy pleaded with the fairy, and ah, what a difference then. The fairy stopped tormenting them, and he turned the sugar church back into stone. The townspeople cut down the wood in the marketplace and bought new animals. But they could never get the church quite right again. Even today there is something odd about the church in Chesterfield. it is not quite like other churches.
Strange was silent for a moment. Then he said, Is it your opinion, Mr. Norrell, that fairies have left England completely?
I do not know. There are many stories of Englishmen and women meeting with fairies in out-of-the-way places in the last 300 or 400 years, but as none of these people were scholars or magicians, their evidence cannot be said to be worth a great deal. When you and I summon fairies, I mean, he added hastily, if we were so ill-advised as to do such a thing, then providing we cast our spells correctly, the fairies will appear promptly. But where they come from, or by what paths they travel, is uncertain. In Jan Usglas's day, very plain roads were built that led out of England into Faery, wide green roads between high green hedges or stone walls. Those roads still exist, but I do not think fairies use them nowadays any more than Christians. The roads are all overgrown and ruined. They have a lonely look, and I'm told that people avoid them.
People believe that fairy roads are unlucky, said Strange.
Well, they're foolish, said Norrell. Fairy roads cannot hurt them. Fairy roads lead nowhere at all.
Footnote 3. Now, whether Mr. Norrell was right to say that fairy roads can do no harm is debatable. They are eerie places, and there are dozens of tales of the strange adventures which befall people who attempted to travel along them. The following is one of the better known. It's hard to say what precisely was the fate suffered by the people in the road. Certainly it is not a fate you or I would wish to share. In Yorkshire, in the late 16th century, there was a man who had a farm. Early one morning in summer, he went out with two or three of his men to begin the haymaking. A white mist lay upon the land, and the air was cool. Along one side of the field, there was an ancient fairy road, bounded by high hawthorn hedges. Tall grass and young saplings grew in the road, and even on the brightest day it was dim and shadowy. The farmer had never seen anyone on the fairy road, but that morning he and his men looked up and saw a group of people coming along it. Their faces were strange, and they were outlandishly dressed. One among them, a man, strode ahead of the others. He left the road and came into the field. He was dressed in black and was young and handsome, and though they had never seen him before, the farmer and his men knew him immediately. It was the magician king, Jan Usglas. They knelt before him, and he raised them up. He told them that he was on a journey, and they brought him a horse and some food and drink. They went and fetched their wives and children, and Jan Usglas blessed them and gave them good fortune. The farmer looked doubtfully at the strange people who remained in the fairy road, but Jan Usglas told the farmer not to be afraid. He promised him that the people could do him no harm. Then he rode away. The strange people in the ancient road lingered a little while, but when the first rays of the strong summer sun touched them, they disappeared with the mist. And what of the half-human descendants of fairies? Do they inherit their forefathers' knowledge and powers? Asked Strange.
Oh, that is quite another question. Many people nowadays have surnames that reveal their ancestors' fairy origins. Otherlander and Fairchild are two. Elphick is another. And fairy, obviously. I remember there was a Tom Otherlander who worked upon one of our farms when I was a child, but it's quite rare for any of these descendants of fairies to exhibit the least magical talent. Indeed, more often than not, they have a reputation for malice, pride, and laziness, all vices for which their fairy ancestors were well known.
The next day, Strange met with the royal dukes and told them how much he regretted that he'd been unable to alleviate the king's madness. Their royal highnesses were sorry to hear it, but they were not at all surprised. It was the outcome they had expected, and they assured Strange that they did not blame him in the least. In fact, they were pleased with all he had done, and they particularly liked that he had not charged them a fee. As a reward, they granted him their royal warrants. This meant that he could, if he wished, put gilt and plaster images of all their 5 coats of arms above his door in Soho Square, and he was at liberty to tell anyone he liked that he was magician to the royal dukes, by appointment. Strange did not tell the dukes that he deserved their gratitude more than they knew. He was quite certain he had saved the king from some horrible fate or other. He simply did not know what it was. Chapter 34. On the Edge of the Desert. November 1814. Stephen and the gentleman with the thistledown hair were walking through the streets of a strange town.
"Are you not growing weary, sir?"
asked Stephen.
I know that I am. We've been walking here for hours.
The gentleman let out a burst of high-pitched laughter.
My dear Stephen, you've only just this instant arrived. A moment ago you were at Lady Pole's house, being forced to perform some menial task at the bidding of her wicked husband.
Oh, said Stephen. He realized that the last thing he remembered was cleaning the silver in his little room near the kitchen. But that seemed like, oh, years ago. He looked around him. There was nothing here he recognized. Even the smell of the place, a mixture of spices, coffee, rotting vegetables and roasting meats, was new to him. He sighed.
It is this magic, sir. It's so very confusing.
The gentleman squeezed his arm affectionately. The town appeared to be built upon a steep hillside. There did not seem to be any proper streets, but only narrow alleyways composed mainly of steps that wound up and down between the houses. The houses themselves were of the utmost simplicity, one might say severity. The walls were made of earth or clay painted white. The doorways had plain wooden doors, and the windows had plain wooden shutters. The steps of the alleys were also painted white. In all the town, there did not seem to be so much as a spot of colour anywhere to relieve the eye. No flower in a flower pot upon a windowsill, no painted toy left where a child had abandoned it in a doorway. Walking through these narrow streets was, thought Stephen, a rather like losing oneself in the folds of an enormous linen napkin. It was eerily silent. As they went up and down the narrow steps, they heard the murmur of grave conversation coming from the houses. But there was no laughter, no song, no child's voice raised in excitement. From time to time they met an inhabitant of the town, a solemn, dark-faced man dressed in a white robe and pantaloons, with a white turban upon his head. All carried walking sticks, even the young men, though in truth none of them seemed to be very young. The inhabitants of this town had been born old. They saw only one woman, at least the gentleman with the thistledown hair said it was a woman. She stood at her husband's side, robed from the crown of her head to the tip of her toe, in a single garment, the colour of shadows. When Stephen first saw her, she had her back to him, and it seemed in keeping with the dreamlike atmosphere of the place that as she turned slowly towards him, he saw that her face was not a face at all, but a panel of densely embroidered cloth of the same dusky hue as the rest of her garment.
These people are very strange, whispered Stephen, but they do not appear to be surprised to find us here.
Oh, said the gentleman, it is part of the magic I have done that you and I should appear to them as two of their number. They are quite convinced that they have known us since childhood. Moreover, you will find that you understand them perfectly, and they will understand you, in spite of the obscurity of their language, which is scarcely comprehensible to their own countrymen 25 miles away.
Presumably, Stephen thought, it was also part of the magic that the town's inhabitants should not notice how loud the gentleman spoke, and how his words echoed from every whitewashed corner. The street they were descending turned a corner and ended abruptly at a low wall that had been put there to prevent unwary pedestrians from tumbling off the hill. From this spot, the surrounding country could be viewed. A desolate valley of white rock lay before them under a cloudless sky. A hot wind blew across it. It was a world from which all flesh had been stripped, leaving only the bones. Stephen would have supposed that this place was a dream or part of his enchantment, had not the gentleman with the thistledown hair informed him excitedly that this was
Africa, your ancestral soil, my dear Stephen.
But, thought Stephen, my ancestors did not live here, I'm sure. These people are darker than Englishmen, but they are far fairer than me. They are Arabs, I suppose.
Out loud he said,
Are we going anywhere in particular, sir? To the market, Stephen.
Stephen was glad to hear it. The silence and emptiness were oppressive. The market presumably would have some noise, some bustle. But the market of this town proved to be of a very curious character. It was situated close to the high town walls, just by a great wooden gate. There were no stalls, no crowds of eager people going about to view the wares. Instead, everyone who felt at all inclined to buy anything sat silently upon the ground with his hands folded, while a market official, a sort of auctioneer, carried the goods about and showed them to the prospective buyers. The auctioneer named the last price he had been offered, and the buyer either shook his head or offered a higher one.
There was not a great deal of variety in the goods. There were some bales of fine cloth and some embroidered articles, but mostly it was carpets. When Stephen remarked upon this to his companion, the gentleman replied, "Their religion is of the strictest sort, Stephen. Almost everything is forbidden to them, except carpets." Stephen watched them as they went mournfully about the market. These men whose mouths were perpetually closed, lest they spoke some forbidden word, whose eyes were perpetually averted from forbidden sights, whose hands refrained at every moment from some forbidden act. It seemed to him that they did little more than half exist. They might as well have been dreams or ghosts. In the silent town and the silent countryside, only the hot wind seemed to have any real substance. Stephen felt he would not be surprised if one day the wind blew the town and its inhabitants entirely away. Stephen and the gentleman seated themselves in a corner of the market beneath a tattered brown awning. "Why are we here, sir?" asked Stephen.
"So that we may have some quiet conversation, Stephen. A most serious matter has arisen. I'm sorry to have to tell you that all our wonderful plans have been rudely overturned, and once again it is the magicians who thwart us. Never was there such a rascally pair of men. Their only pleasure, I think, is in demonstrating their contempt of us. But one day, I believe—"
The gentleman was a great deal more interested in abusing the magicians than he was in making his meaning clear, and so it was some time before Stephen was able to understand what had happened. It seemed that Jonathan Strange had paid a visit to the King of England, for what reason the gentleman did not explain, and the gentleman had gone too, with the idea first of seeing what the magician did, and secondly, of looking at the King of England.
"I do not know how it is, but for some reason I never paid my respects to His Majesty before. I discovered him to be a most delightful old person, very respectful to me. We had a great deal of conversation. He has suffered much from the cruel treatment of his subjects. The English take great pleasure in humbling the great and the noble. A great many worthies throughout history have suffered from their vicious persecutions. People such as Charles I, Julius Caesar, and above all, you and me."
"I beg your pardon, sir, but you mentioned plans. What plans are these?"
"Why, our plans to make you King of England, of course. You are not forgotten."
"No, indeed, but—"
"Well, I do not know what may be your opinion, dearest Stephen," declared the gentleman, not waiting to find out. "But I confess I grow weary of waiting for your wonderful destiny to happen of its own accord. I am very much inclined to anticipate the tardy fates and make you king myself. Who knows? Perhaps I am meant to be the noble instrument that raises you to the lofty position that is yours by right. Nothing seems so likely. Well, while the king and I were talking, it occurred to me that the first step to making you king was to get rid of him. Observe, I meant the old man no harm. Upon the contrary, I wrapped his soul in sweetness and made him happier than he has been in many a long year. But this would not do for the magician. I had barely begun to weave an enchantment when the magician began to work against me. He employed ancient fairy magic of immense power. I was never more surprised in my life. Who could have supposed that he would have known how to do such a thing?"
The gentleman paused in his tirade long enough for Stephen to say, "Grateful as I am for your care of me, sir, I feel obliged to observe that the present king has 13 sons and daughters, the eldest of whom is already governing the country. Even if the king were dead, the crown would certainly pass to one of them."
"Yes, yes, but the king's children are all fat and stupid. Who wishes to be governed by such frights? When the people of England understand that they might instead be governed by you, Stephen, who are all elegance and charm and whose noble countenance would look so well upon a coin, why, they must be very dull indeed if they are not immediately delighted and rush to support your cause."
The gentleman, thought Stephen, understood the character of Englishmen a great deal less than he supposed. At that moment, their conversation was interrupted by a most barbaric sound. A great horn was being blown. A number of men rushed forward and heaved the great town gates shut. Thinking that perhaps some danger threatened the town, Stephen looked around in alarm. "Sir, what is happening?"
"Oh, it's these people's custom to shut the gate every night against the wicked heathen," said the gentleman languidly, "by which they mean everyone except themselves. But tell me your opinion, Stephen. What should we do?
Do, sir? About what?
The magicians, Stephen. The magicians. It is clear to me now that as soon as your wonderful destiny begins to unfold, they are certain to interfere. Though why it should matter to them who is the King of England, I cannot tell. I suppose, being ugly and stupid themselves, they prefer to have a king the same. No, they are our enemies, and consequently it behoves us to seek a way to destroy them utterly. Poison? Knives? Pistols?
The auctioneer approached, holding out yet another carpet.
20 silver pennies,
he said in a slow, deliberate tone, as if he were pronouncing a righteous doom upon all the world. The gentleman with the thistledown hair regarded the carpet thoughtfully.
It is possible, of course, he said, to imprison someone within the pattern of a carpet for 1,000 years or so. That is a particularly horrible fate, which I always reserve for people who have offended me deeply, as have these magicians. The endless repetition of colour and pattern, not to mention the irritation of the dust and the humiliation of stains, never fails to render the prisoner completely mad. The prisoner always emerges from the carpet, determined to wreak revenge upon all the world, and then the magicians and heroes of that age must join together to kill him, or more usually imprison him a second time for yet more thousands of years in some even more ghastly prison. And so he goes on growing in madness and evil as the millennia pass. Yes, carpets.
Perhaps, thank you, said Stephen to the auctioneer quickly. But we have no wish to buy this carpet. Pray, sir, pass on.
You are right, Stephen, said the gentleman. Whatever their faults, these magicians have proved themselves most adept at avoiding enchantments. We must find some other way to crush their spirits so that they no longer have the will to oppose us. We must make them wish they had never taken up the practice of magic.
Chapter 35 The Nottinghamshire Gentleman, November 1814. During Strange's 3-year absence, Mr. Drawlight and Mr. Lascelles had enjoyed a little revival of their influence over Mr. Norrell. Anyone wishing to talk to Mr. Norrell or to ask for Mr. Norrell's assistance had been obliged to apply first to them. They had advised Mr. Norrell upon the best way of managing the ministers, and the ministers upon the best way of managing Mr. Norrell. As friends and counsellors of England's most eminent magician, their acquaintance had been solicited by all the wealthiest and most fashionable people in the kingdom. After Strange's return, they continued to wait upon Mr. Norrell as assiduously as ever. But now it was Strange's opinion which Mr. Norrell most wished to hear, and Strange's advice which he sought before any other. Naturally, this was not a state of affairs to please them, and Drawlight in particular did all that was in his power to increase those little annoyances and resentments which each magician occasionally felt at the behaviour of the other.
"I cannot believe that I do not know something that would harm him," he said to Lascelles. "There are some very odd stories about what he did in Spain. Several people have told me that he raised a whole army of dead soldiers to fight the French, corpses with shattered limbs and eyes hanging by a thread, and every sort of horror that you can imagine. What do you suppose Norrell would say if he heard that?"
Lascelles sighed.
"I wish I could convince you of the futility of trying to manufacture a quarrel between them. They will do that themselves sooner or later."
A few days after Strange's visit to the king, a crowd of Mr. Norrell's friends and admirers gathered in the library at Hanover Square with the object of admiring a new portrait of the two magicians by Mr. Lawrence. Footnote 1. This portrait, now lost, hung in Mr. Norrell's library from November 1814 until the summer of the following year, when it was removed. It has not been seen since. The following extract from a volume of memoirs describes the difficulties experienced by Mr. Lawrence, later Sir Thomas Lawrence, in painting the portrait. It is also of interest for the light it sheds upon the relationship of Norrell and Strange in late 1814. It seems that in spite of many provocations, Strange was still struggling to bear patiently with the older magician and to encourage others to do the same. The two magicians sat for the picture in Mr. Norrell's library. Mr. Lawrence found Mr. Strange to be a most agreeable man, and Strange's part of the portrait progressed very well. Mr. Norrell, on the other hand, was very restless from the start.
He would shift about in his chair and crane his neck as if he were trying to catch sight of Mr. Lawrence's hands, a futile endeavour as the easel stood between them. Mr. Lawrence supposed he must be anxious about the picture and assured him it went well. Mr. Lawrence added that Mr. Norrell might look if he wished, but this did nothing to cure Mr. Norrell's fidgets. All at once, Mr. Norrell addressed Mr. Strange, who was in the room and busy writing a letter to one of the ministers. "Mr. Strange, I feel a draught. I do believe that the window behind Mr. Lawrence is open. Pray, Mr. Strange, go and see if the window is open." Without looking up, Strange replied, "No, the window is not open. You are mistaken." A few minutes later, Mr. Norrell thought he heard a pie seller in the square and begged Mr. Strange to go to the window and look out. But once again, Mr. Strange refused. Next, it was a duchess's coach that Mr. Norrell heard. He tried everything he could think of to make Mr. Strange go to the window, but Mr. Strange would not go. This was very odd, and Mr. Lawrence began to suspect that all Mr. Norrell's agitation had nothing to do with imaginary drafts or pie sellers or duchesses, but that it had something to do with the painting. So when Mr. Norrell went out of the room, Mr. Lawrence asked Mr. Strange what the matter was. At first, Mr. Strange insisted that nothing was wrong, but Mr. Lawrence was determined to find out and pressed Mr. Strange to tell him the truth. Mr. Strange sighed. "Oh, very well. He has got it into his head that you are copying spells out of his books behind your easel." Mr. Lawrence was shocked. He had painted the greatest in the land and never before been suspected of stealing. This was not the sort of treatment he expected. "Come," said Mr. Strange gently, "do not be angry. If any man in England deserves our patience, it is Mr. Norrell. All the future of English magic is on his shoulders, and I assure you he feels it very keenly. It makes him a little eccentric. What would be your sensations, I wonder, Mr. Lawrence, if you woke one morning and found yourself the only artist in Europe? Would not you feel a little lonely? Would you not feel the watchful gaze of Michelangelo and Raphael and Rembrandt and all the rest of them upon you, as if they both defied and implored you to equal their achievements? Would you not sometimes be out of spirits and out of temper?" From Recollections of Sir Thomas Lawrence During an Intimacy of Nearly 30 Years by Miss Croft. Mr. Lascelles and Mr. Drawlight were there, as were Mr. and Mrs. Strange and several of the King's ministers. The portrait showed Mr. Norrell in his plain grey coat and his old-fashioned wig. Both coat and wig seemed a little too large for him. He appeared to have withdrawn inside them, and his small blue eyes looked out at the world with a curious mix of fearfulness and arrogance that put Sir Walter Pole in mind of his valet's cat. Most people, it seemed, were having to put themselves to a little effort to find anything flattering to say of Mr. Norrell's half of the picture, but everyone was happy to admire Strange's half. Strange was painted behind Mr. Norrell, half-sitting, half-leaning against a little table, entirely at his ease, with his mocking half-smile and his eyes full of smiles and secrets and spells, just as a magician's eyes should be.
"Oh, it is an excellent thing," enthused a lady. "See how the darkness of the mirror behind the figures sets off Mr. Strange's head."
"People always imagine the magicians and mirrors go together," complained Mr. Norrell. "There is no mirror in that part of my library."
"Artists are tricky fellows, sir, forever reshaping the world according to some design of their own," said Strange. "Indeed, they are not unlike magicians in that, and yet he has made a curious piece of work of it. It's more like a door than a mirror, it is so dark. I can almost feel a draught coming from it. I do not like to see myself sitting so close to it. I'm afraid that I may catch cold." One of the ministers, who had never been in Mr. Norrell's library before, made some admiring remark about its harmonious proportions and style of fitting up, which led other people to say how beautiful they thought it.
"It is certainly a very fine room," agreed Drawlight, "but it is really nothing in comparison with the library at Hertfew Abbey. That is truly a charming room. I never in my life saw anything so delightful, so complete. There are little pointed arches and a dome with pillars in the Gothic style, and the carvings of leaves, dried and twisted leaves, as if withered by some horrid winter blast, all done in good English oak and ash and elm, are the most perfect things I ever saw. Mr. Norrell," I said when I saw them, "there are depths in you that we have not suspected. You are quite a romantic, sir."
Mr. Norrell looked as if he did not much like to hear the library at Hertfew talked about so much, but Mr. Drawlight continued regardless.
It is like being in a wood, a pretty little wood, late in the year, and the bindings of the books, being all tan and brown and dry with age, compound that impression. Indeed, there are as many books, it seems, as the leaves in a wood. Mr. Drawlight paused. And were you ever at Hurtfew, Mr. Strange?
Strange replied that he had not yet had that pleasure.
Oh, you should go, Drawlight smiled spitefully. Indeed you should. It is truly wonderful.
Norrell looked anxiously at Strange, but Strange did not reply. He had turned his back on them all and was gazing intently at his own portrait. As the others moved away and began to speak of something else, Sir Walter murmured,
You must not mind his malice.
Said Strange.
Oh, it's not that. It is the mirror.
Does it not look as if one could just walk into it? It would not be so difficult, I think. One could use a spell of revelation. Of unravelling, or perhaps both. The way would be clear before one. One step forward, and away. He looked around him and said, And there are days when I would be away.
Where?
Sir Walter was surprised. There was no place he found so much to his liking as London, with its gaslights and its shops, its coffee houses and clubs, its 1,000 pretty women, and its 1,000 varieties of gossip, and he imagined it must be the same for everyone. Oh, wherever men of my sort used to go long ago, wandering on paths that other men have not seen, behind the sky, on the other side of the rain. Strange sighed again, and his right foot tapped impatiently on Mr. Norrell's carpet, suggesting that if he did not make up his mind soon to go to the forgotten paths, then his feet would carry him there of their own accord. By 2 o'clock, the visitors had gone, and Mr. Norrell, who was rather anxious to avoid any conversation with Strange, went upstairs and hid himself away in his little room at the back of the house on the second floor. He sat down at his table and began to work. Very soon, he had forgot all about Strange and the library at Hurtfew and all the disagreeable sensations which Drawlight's speech had produced. He was, therefore, somewhat dismayed when a few minutes later there was a knock at the door and Strange walked in.
I beg your pardon for disturbing you, sir, he said, but there's something I wish to ask you.
Oh, said Mr. Norrell, nervously. Well, of course, I'm always very happy to answer any questions you may have, but just now there is a piece of business which I fear I cannot neglect. I have spoken to Lord Liverpool about our plan to secure the coast of Great Britain from storms by magic, and he is quite delighted with it. Lord Liverpool says that every year property to the value of many hundreds of thousands of pounds is destroyed by the sea. Lord Liverpool says that he considers the preservation of property to be the first task of magic in peacetime. As always, his lordship wishes it done immediately, and it is a great deal of work. The county of Cornwall alone will take a week. I fear we must postpone our conversation until some other time.
Strange smiled. If the magic is as urgent as that, sir, then I had better assist you, and we can talk while we work. Where do you begin?
At Yarmouth.
And what are you using? Belisys?
No, not Belisys. There is a reconstruction of Stokes's magic for calming stormy waters in Lanchester's Language of Birds. I'm not so foolish as to suppose that Lanchester greatly resembles Stokesy, but he is the best we have. I have made some revisions to Lanchester, and I'm adding Pevensey's spells of ward and watch.
Footnote 2. Francis Pevensey, 16th-century magician, wrote 18 wonders to be found in the House of Albion. We know that Pevensey was trained by Martin Pale. The 18 wonders has all the characteristics of Pale's magic, including his fondness for complicated diagrams and intricate magical apparatus. For many years, Francis Pevensey occupied a minor but respectable place in English magical history as a follower of Martin Pale, and it was a great surprise to everyone when he suddenly became the subject of one of the bitterest controversies in 18th-century magical theory. It began in 1754 with the discovery of a number of letters in the library of a gentleman in Stamford in Lincolnshire. They were all in an antique hand and signed by Martin Pale. The magical scholars of the period were beside themselves with joy. But upon closer examination, the letters proved to be love letters, with no word of magic in them from beginning to end. They were of the most passionate description imaginable. Pale compared his beloved to a sweet shower of rain falling upon him, to a fire at which he warmed himself, to a torment that he preferred to any comfort.
There were various references to milk-white breasts and perfumed legs and long, soft brown hair in which stars became entangled, and other things not at all interesting to the magical scholars who'd hoped for magic spells. Bale was much addicted to writing his beloved's name, which was Francis, and in one letter he made a sort of punning poem or riddle upon her surname, Pevensey. At first, the 18th-century magical scholars were inclined to argue that Pale's mistress must have been the sister or wife of the other Francis Pevensey. In the 16th century, Francis had been a common name for both men and women. Then Charles Heather Gray published 7 different extracts from the letters, which mentioned 18 wonders in the House of Albion, and showed plainly that Pale's mistress and the author of the book were one and the same person. William Pantler argued that the letters were forgeries. The letters had been found in the library of a Mr. Whittlesey. Mr. Whittlesey had a wife who had written several plays, 2 of which had been performed at the Drury Lane Theatre. Clearly, said Pantler, a woman who would stoop to writing plays would stoop to anything, and he suggested that Mrs. Whittlesey had forged the letters, in order to elevate her sex above the natural place that God had ordained for it. Mr. Whittlesey challenged William Pantler to a duel, and Pantler, who was a scholar through and through and knew nothing of weapons, apologized and published a formal retraction of his accusations against Mrs. Whittlesey. Mr. Norrell was quite happy to employ Pevensey's magic, since he had settled it in his own mind long ago that Pevensey was a man. As to the letters, since they contained no word of magic, he did not concern himself with them. Jonathan Strange took a different view. According to him, only one question needed to be asked and answered in order to settle the matter. Would Martin Pale have taught a woman magic? The answer was again, according to Strange, yes. After all, Martin Pale claimed to have been taught by a woman, Catherine of Winchester. Mr. Norrell pushed some papers towards Strange. Strange studied the papers, and then he too began to work. After a while, Strange said, I recently found a reference in Ormskirk's Revelations of 36 Other Worlds to the kingdom that lies behind mirrors. A kingdom which is apparently full of the most convenient roads by which a traveller may get from one place to another. This would not ordinarily have been a subject to please Mr. Norrell, but he was so relieved to discover that Strange did not intend to quarrel with him about the library at Hurtview that he grew quite communicative. Oh, yes, indeed. There is indeed a path which joins all the mirrors of the world. It was well known to the great medievals. No doubt they trod it often. I fear I cannot give you any more precise information. The writers I have seen all describe it in different ways. Ormskirk says it is a road across a wide, dark moor, whereas Hickman calls it a vast house with many dark passages and great staircases. Footnote 3. Thaddeus Hickman, 1700-38, author of A Life of Martin Pale. Hickman says that within this house there are stone bridges spanning deep chasms and canals of black water flowing between stone walls. To what destination or for what purpose, no one knows. Suddenly Mr. Norrell was in an excellent humour. To sit quietly doing magic with Mr. Strange was to him the very height of enjoyment. And how does the article for the next Gentleman's Magazine come along? He asked. Strange thought for a moment. I have not quite completed it, he said. Oh, what is it about? No, do not tell me. I greatly look forward to reading it. Perhaps you will bring it with you tomorrow.
Oh, tomorrow, certainly.
That evening, Arabella entered the drawing-room of her house in Soho Square and was somewhat surprised to discover that the carpet was now covered with small pieces of paper upon which were written spells and notes and fragments of Norrell's conversation. Strange was standing in the middle of the room, staring down at the papers and pulling his hair. What in the world can I put in the next article for the Gentleman's Magazine? He demanded. I do not know, my love. Has Mr. Norrell made no suggestion? Strange frowned. For some reason, he thinks it's already done. Well, what about trees and magic? Suggested Arabella. You were only saying the other day how interesting the subject is, and very much neglected. Strange took a clean sheet of paper and began rapidly scribbling notes upon it. Oak trees can be befriended and will aid you against your enemies if they think your cause is just. Birch woods are well known for providing doors into faery. Ash trees will never cease to mourn until the Raven King comes home again. Footnote 4. The ivy promised to bind England's enemies
Briars and thorns promised to whip them. The hawthorn said he would answer any question. The birch said he would make doors to other countries. The yew brought us weapons. The raven punished our enemies. The oak watched the distant hills. The rain washed away all sorrow. This traditional English saying supposedly lists the various contracts which John Usglas, the Raven King, made on England's behalf with the forests.
No, no, that will never do. I cannot say that. Norrell would have a fit.
He crumpled up the paper and threw it in the fire.
Oh, then perhaps you will listen for a moment to what I have to say, said Arabella. I paid a visit to Lady Westby's house today, where I met a very odd young lady who seems to be under the impression that you are teaching her magic.
Strange looked up briefly.
I'm not teaching anyone magic, he said.
No, no, my love, said Arabella patiently. I know that you're not. That is what makes it so extraordinary.
And what is the name of this confused young person?
Miss Grey.
I do not know her.
A smart, stylish girl, but not handsome. She is apparently very rich and absolutely wild for magic. Everybody says so. She has a fan decorated with your pictures, yours and Mr. Norrell's, and she has read every word that you and Lord Portishead have ever published.
Strange stared thoughtfully at her for several seconds, so that Arabella mistakenly supposed he must be considering what she had just said. But when he spoke, it was only to say in a tone of gentle reproof, My love, you're standing on my papers.
He took her arm and moved her gently aside.
She told me that she had paid you 400 guineas for the privilege of being your pupil. She says that in return you've sent her letters with descriptions of spells and recommendations of books to read.
400 guineas? Well, that is odd. I might forget a young lady, but I do not think I could forget 400 guineas.
A piece of paper caught Strange's eye, and he picked it up and began to read it.
I thought at first that she might have invented this story in order to make me jealous and cause a quarrel between us. But her mania does not seem to be of that sort. It is not your person she admires. It is your profession. I cannot make head nor tail of it. What can these letters be? Who can have written them?
Strange picked up a little memorandum book. It happened to be Arabella's housekeeping book, and nothing to do with him at all, and began to scribble notes in it.
Jonathan?
Mm-hmm.
What should I say to Miss Grey when I see her next?
Ask her about the 400 guineas. Tell her I have not yet received it.
Jonathan, this is a serious matter.
Well, I quite agree. There are few things as serious as 400 guineas.
Arabella said again that it was the oddest thing in the world.
She told Strange that she was quite concerned upon Miss Grey's account, and she said she wished he would speak to Miss Grey so that the mystery might be resolved.
But she said all this for her own satisfaction, since she knew perfectly well that he was no longer attending to her. A few days later, Strange and Sir Walter Pole were playing at billiards at the Bedford in Covent Garden. The game had come to an impasse, as Sir Walter had begun, as usual, to accuse Strange of transporting billiard balls about the table by magic. Strange declared that he had done no such thing.
"I saw you touch your nose," complained Sir Walter. "Good God," cried Strange. "A man may sneeze, mayn't he? I have a cold."
Two other friends of Strange and Sir Walter, Lieutenant Colonel Colhern Grant and Colonel Manningham, who were watching the game, said that if Strange and Sir Walter merely wished to quarrel, then was it entirely necessary for them to occupy the billiards table to do it? Colhern Grant and Colonel Manningham hinted that there were other people, more interested in the game itself, who were waiting to play. This, developing into a more general argument, unfortunately led two country gentlemen to put their heads round the door and inquire when the table might be free for a game, unaware that on Thursday evenings the billiards room at the Bedford was generally considered to be the personal property of Sir Walter Pole and Jonathan Strange and their particular friends.
"Upon my word," said Colhern Grant, "I do not know, but probably not for a very long time."
The first of the two country gentlemen was a thick-set, solid-looking person, with a coat of heavy brown cloth and boots which would have appeared more to advantage at some provincial market than in the fashionable surroundings of the Bedford. The second country gentleman was a limp little man with an expression of perpetual astonishment.
"But, sir,"
said the first man, addressing Strange in tones of the utmost reasonableness,
"you are talking, not playing. Mr. Tantanley and I are from Nottinghamshire. We have ordered our dinner, but we are told we must wait another hour before it's ready.
Let us play while you have your chat, and then we'll be only too glad to give up the table to you again."
His manner as he said this was perfectly polite, yet it rather rankled with Strange's party. Everything about him plainly spoke him to be a farmer or a tradesman, and they were not best pleased that he took it upon himself to order them about. "If you examine the table," said Strange, "you will see that we have just begun. To ask a gentleman to break off before his game is ended, well, sir, it is a thing that is never done at the Bedford."
"Ah, is it not?" said the Nottinghamshire gentleman pleasantly. "Then I beg your pardon. But perhaps you will not object to telling me whether you think it will be a short game or a long one."
"We have already told you," said Grant. "We do not know."
He gave Strange a look which plainly said, "This fellow is very stupid." It was at this point that the Nottinghamshire gentleman began to suspect that Strange's party were not merely unhelpful, but that they intended to be rude to him. He frowned, and indicated the limp little man with the astonished expression who stood at his side. "It is Mr. Tantony's first visit to London, and he does not desire to come again. I particularly wished to show him the Bedford Coffee House, but I did not think to find people so very disobliging."
"Well, if you do not like it here," said Strange angrily, "then I can only suggest that you go back home to wherever it is. Nottinghamshire, I think you said."
Culhen Grant gave the Nottinghamshire gentleman a very cool look, and remarked to nobody in particular,
"It is no wonder to me that farming is such a parlous condition. Farmers nowadays are always upon the gad. One meets of them at the idlest haunts in the kingdom. They consult nothing but their own pleasure. Is there no wheat to be sown in Nottinghamshire, I wonder? No pigs to be fed?"
"Mr. Tantony and I are not farmers, sir," exclaimed the Nottinghamshire gentleman indignantly. "We are brewers. Gatcombe and Tantony's entire stout is our most celebrated beer, and it is famed throughout 3 counties.
Thank you, but we have beer and brewers enough in London already," remarked Colonel Manningham. "Pray, do not stay upon our account."
"But we are not here to sell beer. We have come for a far nobler purpose than that. Mr. Tantony and I are enthusiasts for magic. We consider that it is every patriotic Englishman's duty to interest himself in the subject. London is no longer merely the capital of Great Britain. It is the centre of our magical scholarship. For many years it was Mr. Tantony's dearest wish that he might learn magic. The art was in such a wretched condition that it made him despair. His friends bade him be more cheerful. We told him that it is when things are at their worst that they start to mend. And we were right, for almost immediately there appeared 2 of the greatest magicians that England has ever known. I refer, of course, to Mr. Norrell and Mr. Strange. The wonders which they have performed have given Englishmen cause to bless the country of their birth again, and encourage Mr. Tantony to hope that he might one day be of their number."
"Indeed. Well, it is my belief that he will be disappointed," observed Strange.
"Then, sir, you could not be more wrong," cried the Nottinghamshire gentleman triumphantly. "Mr. Tantony is being instructed in the magical arts by Mr. Strange himself."
Unfortunately, Strange happened at that moment to be leaning across the table, balanced upon 1 foot to take aim at a billiard ball. So surprised was he at what he heard that he missed the shot entirely, struck his cue against the side of the table, and promptly fell over.
"I think there must be some mistake," said Culhern Grant.
"No, sir, no mistake,"
said the Nottinghamshire gentleman with an air of infuriating calmness. Strange, getting up from the floor, asked,
"What does he look like, this Mr. Strange?"
"Alas," said the Nottinghamshire gentleman, "I cannot give you any precise information upon that point. Mr. Tantony has never met Mr. Strange. Mr. Tantony's education is conducted entirely by letters. But we have great hopes of seeing Mr. Strange in the street. We go to Soho Square tomorrow expressly for the purpose of looking at his house."
"Letters?" exclaimed Strange. "I would think an education by correspondence must be of a very inferior sort," said Sir Walter.
"Not at all," cried the Nottinghamshire gentleman. "Mr. Strange's letters are full of sage advice and remarkable insights into the condition of English magic. Why, only the other day, Mr. Tantony wrote and asked Mr. Strange for a spell to make it stop raining. We get a great deal of rain in our part of Nottinghamshire. The very next day, Mr. Strange wrote back and said that though there were indeed spells that could move rain and sunshine about, like pieces on a chessboard, he would never employ them except in the direst need, and he advised Mr. Tantony to follow his example. English magic," said Mr. Strange, "had grown up upon English soil, and had, in a sense, been nurtured by English rain.
Mr. Strange said it in meddling with English weather. We meddled with England, and in meddling with England, we risked destroying the very foundations of English magic. We thought that a very striking instance of Mr. Strange's genius. Did we not, Mr. Tantalley? The Nottinghamshire man gave his friend a little shake, which made him blink several times.
Did you ever say that?
Murmured Sir Walter.
Why, I think I did, answered Strange. I believe I said something of the sort. When would it have been? Last Friday, I suppose.
And to whom did you say it?
Well, to Norrell, of course.
And was there any other person in the room?
Strange paused.
Drawlight, he said slowly.
Ah.
Sir, said Strange to the Nottinghamshire gentleman, I beg your pardon if I offended you before, but you must admit that there was something about the way in which you spoke to me which was not quite... In short, I have a temper, and you piqued me. I am Jonathan Strange, and I'm sorry to tell you that I have never heard of you or Mr. Tantalley until today. I suspect that Mr. Tantalley and I are both dupes of an unscrupulous man. I presume that Mr. Tantalley pays me for his education. Might I ask where he sends the money? If it is to Little Rider Street, then I shall have the proof I need. Unfortunately, the Nottinghamshire gentleman and Mr. Tantalley had formed an idea of Strange as a tall, deep-chested man with a long white beard, a ponderous way of speaking, and an antiquated mode of dress. As the Mr. Strange who stood before them was slender, clean-shaven, quick of speech, and dressed exactly like every other rich, fashionable gentleman in London, they could not at first be persuaded that this was the right person. "Well, that is easily resolved," said Colhern Grant.
"Of course," said Sir Walter. "I will summon a waiter. Perhaps the word of a servant will do what the word of a gentleman cannot. John, come here, we want you."
"No, no, no, no," cried Grant. "That's not what I meant at all. John, you may go away again. We do not want you."
There are any number of things which Mr. Strange could do which would prove his incomparable magicianship far better than any mere assurances. He is, after all, the greatest magician of the age.
"Surely," said the Nottinghamshire man with a frown, "that title belongs to Mr. Norrell." Colhern Grant smiled.
"Colonel Manningham and I had the honour, sir, to fight with His Grace the Duke of Wellington in Spain. I assure you, we knew nothing of Mr. Norrell there. It was Mr. Strange, this gentleman here, whom we trusted. Now, if he were to perform some startling act of magic, then I do not think you could doubt any longer, and then I'm sure your great respect for English magic and English magicians would not allow you to remain silent a moment longer. I'm sure you would wish to tell him all you know about these forged letters."
Grant looked at the Nottinghamshire gentleman inquiringly.
Well, said the Nottinghamshire gentleman, you're a very queer set of gentlemen, I must say, and what you could mean by spinning me such a tale as this I do not know, for I tell you plainly, I would be very much surprised if the letters proved to be forgeries, when every line, every word, breathes good English magic.
But, said Grant, if, as we suppose, this scoundrel made use of Mr. Strange's own words to concoct his lies, then that would explain it, would it not? Now, in order to prove that he is who we say he is, Mr. Strange shall now show you something that no man living has ever seen.
Why? Said the Nottinghamshire man.
What will he do? Grant smiled broadly and turned to Strange as if he too were suddenly struck with curiosity.
Yes, Strange, tell us, what will you do?
But it was Sir Walter who answered. He nodded in the direction of a large Venetian mirror which took up most of one wall and was at that moment reflecting only darkness, and he declared,
He will walk into that mirror, and he will not come out again.
Chapter 36 All the Mirrors of the World, November 1814. The village of Hampstead is situated 5 miles north of London. In our grandfather's day, it was an entirely unremarkable collection of farmhouses and cottages, but the existence of so rustic a spot close to London attracted large numbers of people to go there to enjoy the sweet air and verdure. A racecourse and bowling green were built for their amusement. Bun shops and tea gardens provided refreshment. Rich people bought summer cottages there, and Hampstead soon became what it is today, one of the favourite resorts of fashionable London society. In a very short space of time, it has grown from a country village to a place of quite respectable size,
almost a little town. 2 hours after Sir Walter, Colonel Grant, Colonel Manningham, and Jonathan Strange had quarrelled with the Nottinghamshire gentleman, a carriage entered Hampstead on the London Road and turned into a dark lane which was overhung with elder bushes, lilacs, and hawthorns. The carriage drove to a house at the end of the lane where it stopped, and Mr. Drawlight got out. The house had once been a farmhouse, but it had been much improved in recent years. Its small country windows, more useful for keeping out the cold than letting in the light, had all been made large and regular. A pillared portico had replaced the mean country doorway. The farmyard had been entirely swept away, and a flower garden and shrubbery established in its place. Mr. Drawlight knocked upon the door. A maidservant answered his knock and immediately conducted him to a drawing room. The room must once have been the farmhouse parlour, but all signs of its original character had disappeared beneath costly French wallpapers, Persian carpets, and English furniture of the newest make and style. Drawlight had not waited there more than a few minutes when a lady entered the room. She was tall, well-formed, and beautiful. Her gown was of scarlet velvet, and her white neck was set off by an intricate necklace of jet beads. Through an open door across the passageway could be glimpsed a dining parlour, as expensively got up as the drawing room. The remains of a meal upon the table showed that the lady had dined alone. It seemed that she had put on the red gown and black necklace for her own amusement.
"Ah, madam," cried Drawlight, leaping up. "I hope you are well."
She made a little gesture of dismissal.
"I suppose I am well, as well as I can be, with scarcely any society and no variety of occupation."
"What?"
cried Drawlight in a shocked voice.
"Are you all alone here?"
"I have one companion, an old aunt. She urges religion upon me."
"Oh, madam," cried Drawlight, "do not waste your energies upon prayers and sermons. You'll get no comfort there. Instead, fix your thoughts upon revenge."
"I shall. I do," she said simply. She sat down upon the sofa opposite the window. "And how are Mr. Strange and Mr. Norrell?"
"Oh, busy, madam, busy, busy, busy. I could wish for their sakes as well as yours that they were less occupied. Only yesterday, Mr. Strange inquired most particularly after you. He wished to know if you were in good spirits." "Oh, tolerable," I told him. "Merely tolerable." "Mr. Strange is shocked, madam, frankly shocked, at the heartless behaviour of your relations."
"Indeed. I wished that his indignation might show itself in more practical ways," she said coolly. "I have paid him more than 100 guineas, and he has done nothing. I am tired of trying to arrange matters through an intermediary, Mr. Drawlight. Convey to Mr. Strange my compliments. Tell him I am ready to meet him wherever he chooses, at any hour of the day or night. All times are alike to me. I have no engagements."
"Ah, madam, how I wish I could do as you ask, how Mr. Strange wishes it, but I fear it is quite impossible."
"So you say, but I have heard no reason, at least none that satisfies me. I suppose Mr. Strange is nervous of what people will say if we are seen together, but our meeting may be quite private. No one need know."
"Oh, madam, you have quite misunderstood Mr. Strange's character. Nothing in the world would please him so much as an opportunity to show the world how he despises your persecutors. It is entirely upon your account that he is so circumspect. He fears—"
But what Mr. Strange feared the lady never learnt, for at that moment Drawlight stopped suddenly and looked about him with an expression of the utmost perplexity upon his face.
"What in the world was that?" he asked.
It was as if a door had opened somewhere, or possibly a series of doors. There was a sensation as of a breeze blowing into the house and bringing with it the half-remembered scents of childhood. There was a shift in the light which seemed to cause all the shadows in the room to fall differently. There was nothing more definite than that, and yet, as often happens when some magic is occurring, both Drawlight and the lady had the strongest impression that nothing in the visible world could be relied upon any more. It was as if one might put out one's hand to touch anything in the room and discover it was no longer there.